very sincere acknowledgement to make. One, to Vidya, to make it possible for me to come and talk to you. And the second, to Dr. Palani. Because 15 years ago, I had told him, and I decided that I'm not going to be in any authority position, come to Bangalore, and with virtually no budget for anything, I arrived here on the scene with
a very ambitious program. The program was, these mountains are moving, what is the rate at which they move? Because that rate in turn will tell us the rate at which strain in the rocks is produced, it will eventually be released in the form of earthquakes. So in other words, what would be seismic hazard in the future? Those numbers are quantified in years from that day. I will never forget the initial boost that I received with virtually no funds at all from Dr. Palani. I'm indeed very grateful to you. I believe the entire community, EPS community in the country should be. If you hold a globe and look at it, you don't have to be told as to what is the most dominant geomorphic feature of this globe. And the most important part of this feature is, you see over here, how the Himalaya-Tibet region is, that its effect is felt as far as Lake Baikal, which is actually opening up astride this point on either side, so far away. Such is the push of the Indian continent into the belly of Tibet that it is creating strain all the way. Indeed, a 5 meter essentially movement of the Indian plate towards the north is only half absorbed here. The rest is distributed between here and this entire region, several thousand kilometers across. So you can imagine the enormous geodynamic significance of this particular movement. Himalayas actually constitute the rim of Tibet. This is Tibet, and you will see how flat it is. In fact, you could just climb these mountains, and on the other side, when you alight in Tibet, you could catch a vehicle there. You know, there may be some vehicles there to take you anywhere you wish. Most of the high mountains lie on this rim. The rim, you can see one is Mount Everest here. This is slightly off the rim, inside Tibet, but otherwise most of these mountains are over here. And this is the high rim that circumscribes Tibet. It doesn't circumscribe, but it bounces on the south. And you can see the same effect over here, taken from a satellite. This is Tibet, flat, although it's a very large, high altitude plateau, and this is the rim of the Himalaya, which is no cloud. Are there mountains elsewhere in the solar system? And this large mountain that you see over here is 27 kilometers high, and it is Mount Olympus on Mars. That's Everest, and this is Mauna Kea in and that rises from the floor of the sea, which is itself several kilometers deep in the Pacific. So there are other eminences in the world. Why 27 kilometer high on Mars? Why only 8 kilometer high on Earth? These are deep questions, and we'll see if we can answer some of these questions. There are other eminences on the planet. The highest elevation on Earth is, of course, Mount Everest. At high, that is the rough position of it. This is Mauna Kea that rises from the floor of the sea, so it is 10,000 meters plus, although above the sea it is not as high as this mountain. And there is another mountain on Earth, on this planet, Chimborazo. It's in Ecuador, and that has a height only of 6,310 meters, but because it happens to be on the bulge of the Earth, it is the highest mountain if you consider the center of the Earth as a reference. So depending on whether you take the center of the Earth or sea level, there are these various ways of finding out as to which are the highest climate. Mountains and earthquakes have been associated for a long time. And indeed, as we now understand, that there is a very intimate relationship between them. Earthquakes are the manifestations of a process which create mountains, virtually meter by meter. And the first clear understanding of how earthquakes are created actually dawned on us after the 1906 earthquake of San Francisco, where vineyards used to be grown in a line, and this line of vineyards was actually offset by the earthquake. So it was quite clear that earthquakes are caused by factors. And that was the first time when it became explicit in our minds that wherever we have earthquake, there is some fracturing taking place. Not much was understood in terms of what is the material behavior of the earth, but of course there are some conclusions that you begin to deduce. If it's fracturing, it must be brittle. If it is brittle, it must be colder, and so on. And wherever the fractures are not taking place, then of course the material may not be brittle, or maybe the stresses are not active. Soon, scientists learned how to locate these earthquakes. But I shan't tarry here to tell you that. And that brought forth an amazing fact that the earthquakes are really about 99% of all the earthquakes that occur on Earth are confined to this belt, and so are the volcanoes. And this belt together will run into something like 40,000 kilometers, whereas the width is at most about 100 kilometers. So these are long linear belts. There's another belt which branches off here, goes into the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. And remember that, I'll have occasion to come back to it a couple of times. It's right in the middle of, and it even takes a curve as these two congruent closing features of the continents do. And there is another one that starts from East Africa, goes right to the Red Sea, which is actually opening to the Himalayas, and ends up here to the Andaman Sumatra, which was this locale of a very big earthquake that caused tsunami, and joins the Pacific one at the island of Philippines. So these are the two long, virtually connected fracture zones, and the question arises, what do they do? How deep do they go? Do they dissect the outer brittle lip of the Earth in some way? But all these questions remain unanswered for a long time. In the meantime, however, scientists learned how to do a CAT scan using these seismic waves, which travel like this, because the velocity changes, becomes small as the waves enter the deep. And obeying Snell's law, you can calculate that they will take these paths. When they come back with the record of their reconnoitering journey, fortunately, at the time when all this began to happen and instruments were created, a mathematical theory was already in place for the scientists to be able to interpret as to what the physical properties of the material through which they travel would look like. And immediately showed that there's an inner core, which is solid. There's a core of material above this solid, which is a liquid state, and perpetually conducting. And at that high pressure, and of course it's largely metal, behaves as the armature of a dynamo, and is the seat of the magnetic field, which many of us use and are protected by in many ways. Above this core is the mantle, and on top of the mantle is the crust. And the crust is amplified here to show you this is the part of the crust. But there is an upper part of the lid, the brittle lid of the Earth, which we call lithosphere, and the Greek word lithos, which means rock. Just underneath the lithosphere, the material melts. It melts for a variety of reasons, because there is a thermal gradient, and also because planet Earth happens to have water, and a small percentage of this water is a part of the constituent of those rocky material, which lowers the melting point. Therefore, it is fortuitous that just at a depth of about 100 kilometers, which is here, based on this green thing, that the material partially melts. And when that happens, then the upper brittle material, if you fracture it, is virtually free to glide on the surface. And that is what planet Earth, that's what makes planet Earth very different from any other materials. That's what we learned. We still believe that if you put a mountain load on the crust, it will just stay like that, a block of steel on a table. But the Himalayas taught us a lesson. This happened in 19th century when surveyors began surveying the region. In fact, East India Company very jealously regarded all the territory. It nibbled bit by bit, and it had to be surveyed. But they came across an amazing fact, and that was that when we measured distances between points using two different methods, one by measuring the angle of the vertical between these two points, because the earth is spherical, so the vertical goes on changing, and if you know the angle between two points, then you can find out the distance, and the other is by measurement. And they found that these two were discrepant. They didn't agree with each other, but the scale of the measurements and precision was so high that scientists believed that there must be an effect which is somewhere hidden, not been accounted for, and that was this effect. That this block is not resting there without perturbing the surface. So we began to calculate, and they said that, oh, that's because the vertical at this point was wrongly measured. The vertical was here, but actually the mountain is pulling the plumb line, and as the mountain pulls the plumb line, the vertical gets a little more tilted, and that should cause, they actually calculated the effect of the mountain, and found out that this effect should be about 5 minutes apart. I beg your pardon. They calculated that the discrepancy was 5 minutes apart, but when they put the effect of the mountain, they found that at first they didn't suspect the mountains are pulling, and when they suspected that it is pulling and it is the cause, they found that it's not pulling hard enough, because that effect should have been 15 rather than 5. What is observed is 5, what is calculated is 15. And then there were two scientists, Pratt and Airy. Airy was the archdeacon in Calcutta, and they assumed that the Himalayas are actually underlain by low density material, so there's a defect of material here which is causing a defect in the attraction. This is called isostasy. That means that this load is actually supported not like this, but it is supported like icebergs or water. And this was a great lesson for scientists, that henceforth one will have to think that if this layer is very rigid, it is going to be depressed. And should it so happen, as indeed it happens on Earth, just before underneath the lithosphere the material is softer, then after some time, the material here will start to flow. And as it flows, more and more of this load will sink in. But that low density material goes in, and that's how, like iceberg, it supports itself. So we'll keep that in mind when trying to understand. So that's how they are supported. How are they created? This is Mount Fuji, and I don't have to explain to you how it's created, so that's quite manifest. But when you came up to Almora from Haldwani, you saw these mountains. You saw these mountains made of sedimentary rock long, long time ago, indeed so long ago, that they do not have any fossils. They are precambrian rocks. And they also show signs of large horizontal offsets. So these were very difficult concepts for geologists to contend with until about the middle of the last century, because large displacements were a kind of a heretic assumptions, and that heresy was brought into explicit discussion by the suggestion by a German meteorologist in 1912 that this is not quite fortuitous, that these opposing edges should be congruent. In fact, they were together once and they have been separated now, which would mean large horizontal displacement, became therefore heresy. No. Although scientists took care to show that if you put these together, you can show the contiguity of rocks which must have existed before they parted and which are now separated far away. And indeed, fossils which are now extinct, like this Thesaurosaurus, are found in certain parts, which will only explain their existence if you assume that these two continents were together. Also, it was found that there are signs, visible geological manifestations of glaciation in these parts of these continents, and you can explain those only if you bring them here together at that particular time. These rocks are dated, so one knows what time it is, about 250 million years ago, and at that time they must be together. Alpine geologists, where a lot of geology had been unraveled, had shown, had actually seen that this is the way these strata seem to have overridden each other, suggesting compression, and therefore, in spite of the fact that for half a century there was this not proven, but certain evidence that large displacements had taken place, it was continuously rejected because there was no idea of mechanism. How will it happen? We didn't know the difference between the continent and oceanic rocks, and this suggestion of large displacement suggested that somehow the continents have plowed over the oceans, which of course would be an impossibility. But of course, with our new understanding of this stratospheric discontinuity, which is a rheological discontinuity in the sense of material properties change, and therefore the upper part is free to glide over it, makes that possible, as we shall see. Here we enter something which is very important, and we only really understood it in the 1950s, again about the middle of the century. But imagine, for example, that the Aborigines here 30,000 years ago cooking their meal or something. These are rocks. Your rocks have sometimes magnetic elements like magnetites, and when the rocks are heated, then the rocks are in a little more plastic state, and the magnetic grains reorient themselves to align themselves with the direction of the magnetic field. And when the rock cools, when these people have gone, then it retains that direction as a fossil magnetization of that time of the Earth's magnetic field at that particular point. And if you appreciate the fact that the Earth's magnetic field looks like this, well, that's one pole into the other pole, then everywhere as you go along, here the field is vertical. At the equator, the field is, because the vertical at the equator is in this direction, the field is horizontal, elsewhere it is intermediate. If you can find out what is the inclination of the field, you know at what latitude you are. So this fossil magnetization becomes the indicator of the latitude. Well, when scientists arrive on the scene 30,000 years later, they noticed one very amazing fact. They found out that this was magnetized in a direction which was opposite, exactly opposite to the direction in which the magnetic field now is. You can see these arrows going in that direction, here in the opposite direction. And they began to wonder as to how is this possible. Unless you take that piece of rock 180 degrees on the other side of the Earth, it would not experience that direction of magnetization. And therefore the question arose, is it possible that the Earth's magnetic field reverses itself periodically? And the scientists got to work with dynamicists, and they developed some model of a dynamo, which is shown in the left upper part. It is in this liquid core that I referred to a little while ago. Convection in the liquid core through an electromagnetic action causes magnetic electric currents to flow, which have their own magnetism. That only shows how rocks acquire magnetization. So there's a fossil magnetization all the time. Rocks which have magnetite are stronger magnetite. Sedimentary rocks also, when they're settling, the grains are settling down, get oriented, and when they are compacted, they also have fossil magnetization, but of a much weaker kind. But they all have some other fossil magnetization. So magnetic field can grant a rock according to where it is on the Earth, which latitude, and it can also tell you whether it is magnetized in the direction of the Earth field today or in the opposite direction. Fortunately, this reversal seems to have been not exactly periodic. And because it wasn't exactly periodic, scientists looked at rocks in the 1950s, was a time when radioactive dating was possible. They could date these rocks, and they found out that in certain ages, the magnetic field was in this direction, and in other ages, they were completely reversed. The whole chronology of magnetic field reversals was built up, and they even tried working out as to what could be the possible ways in which this reversal could be happening. And here's the cartoon, which actually comes out of mathematical model of the geodynamo, which shows how the North Pole turns to South Pole, and so on. And I might mention that before the actual slip takes place, that takes place over a period of about 2,000 years, and then it stays for a few 100,000 years, the magnetic field strength declines. There is a further suggestion today that it might be, we might be at the threshold of a change, because the magnetic field over the last couple of hundred years have declined by about 10%. So that's something to think about. Magnetic field is something that shields the deadly rays from the sun from hitting our tissues and striking us dead. And if the magnetic field were to weaken, because it's going to go in the other direction, for ever so short a time, geologically a few thousand years, it could be catastrophic. So scientists immediately got to work, and the Tata Institute of Fundamental Research immediately set up a section to work on it, looking at the magnetization of rocks, and asking as to what do those fossil magnetizations demand. Do they demand? Do they confirm that you are at the right latitude? Or do they have directions which will require that you move the whole landmass somewhere else on Earth till there is a concord? And when that was done, then they found that about 250 million years ago, east continents of Africa, South America, Australia, that's New Guinea, and India had to be in this position, all huddled together in a big landmass. And if you remember in 1912, this is what Wegener was suggesting, which had been sometimes even maliciously objected to and refuted by others. So this raged on, but here was the paleomagnetism, the fossil magnetism was the arbiter, and it demanded that you have to reassemble. I bring you to this because this will also be the beginning of our story of the Himalaya. India is still here. The rocks that you see over here were deposited, of igneous, were deposited on the northern edge of this. There's a whole oceanic apron that is attached to this as it starts moving. And you will see how it passes the Himalaya and how whatever we see can be explained in that particular way. So I won't take too long here except to say that there's a sociological effect on science also, as many of us realize. And at the end of the war, a lot of ships became free to do scientific work because they were not yoked to the military purpose. And there were some good scientists who had actually been yoked into marine service during the war because they were clever at finding mines and so on and so forth. One of them, two of them, was Hess, and Hess from Princeton, and Bullard from Cambridge. And the other was Patrick Blackett, who of course invented a magnetometer. That's another story. He invented it. Test a fundamental principle, and it turned out that fundamental principle does not hold. So he wrote a negative paper in the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society. But in the process, he had invented a magnetometer which could measure extremely weak magnetic fields in rocks, and therefore made it possible for a very large number of rocks distributed over the continent to be brought to bear a witness as to where they were. So that's the sociological effect, and there were revolutionary results which started tumbling out, because not surprising, because oceans cover 70% of the surface, and we started finding the oceans. Bullard started looking at the structure of the oceans. He found those rocks were different. They were richer in iron and magnesium, and therefore at a certain temperature they will be still brittle when the crustal rocks which have silica in it will become ductile, and they are heavier. They will have density of something like 3,200 kilograms per cubic meter, as opposed to the crustal rocks, which will be skimmed out like cream out of milk. And those crustal rocks are the rocks that you see all around here, which in contrast have a density of about 2,700 kilograms per cubic meter. So these were the new results that came, that the ocean floors were branded by magnetic lineage, which were in one direction, and if you moved a certain distance away, a few tens of kilometers, they were in another, completely 180 degrees out. that sea floor at ages which are nowhere more than 200 million years as compared to these rocks, which even after they have come all the way from Antarctic are at least 500 million years old. Earthquake mechanisms, they are consistent with certain things, heat flow, and of course, boundary. So, within about 10 years, everything changed. The old wave changed, horizontal displacement began to be accepted as the main way the Earth does. Now, here, you know, this is the ocean between Africa and South America, the Americas over here. That's the axial region where you find red, and that red axis shows that the rocks there are magnetized in the normal direction this way. And this began to happen as compared to the width of the sea, you know, which has taken several million years, just about 70,000 years. So that's why you see that. And then for a long time it was reversed, which is there yellow, then normal again, reverse again, and so on. So Harry Hayes, who had actually doubled up as an admiral, was a very distinguished scientist at Princeton. When he returned to his work, he put forth this hypothesis that the ocean floor is actually moving like a magnetic tape recorder. And as the Earth's magnetic field flips from north to south, and you see over here, new material comes in deals here, and then is pushed apart to make way for another new material. And as they congeal, they acquire the magnetization of the direction of the magnetic field. And that is how you get branded magnetically in this way. And when you see, when you take a ship and throw a magnetometer behind it and go from here to there, you will find that the magnetic field changes alternately. So this could explain as to how these two separated. These two must have separated to cause that effect. We still don't didn't at this stage still know how they separated, but it was quite clear that you could no longer hedge that question. Better hedge. And thus was born this standard model as to how the Earth works within less than a few years, even before the objection that had delayed the existence, the understanding and the acceptance of horizontal displacement, that valid mechanism remains elusive even today. So that is what a philosopher, an American philosopher, Kuhn, would call as a kind of a religious conversion rather than something based on explicit scientific reasoning. So I did explain this, but you can understand it. The heat of the Earth causes this convection to come. New material comes. It forms over here. And of course, this was the continent put together, and the new material broke through it and got congealed here at these edges. So it will look something like this. Those were the two continents which were once together. Now they are rifted apart. This layer over here, which is a layer of partial melt, now makes it possible for these to glide without much resistance. And as this material moves, it gets branded magnetically. So it's a very simple kind of convection that explains it. There are complexities, of course, but that's the picture that you'll see. But what will happen to this ocean floor as it goes away and away from this spreading axis? It will cool down, it will thicken, its density will increase, and eventually it will become gravitationally unstable and go back into the Earth's mantle to complete the convection itself. So that is why the ocean floors, they die young. And they die virtually 200 million years after they are born, because they become dense enough by that time to subduct. And this kind of a subduction is something which is happening all along the Andaman Sumatra islands, which caused the earthquake and the tsunami last time. So several things were explained immediately, but still in a kinematic way, we still do not have, even up to this day, we do not have an understanding of what are the forces that drive them. We don't have a dynamic understanding, it's a kinematic model, and that was responsible for the success of this particular theory, kinematic theory, that it's able to explain. And here is that effect, abduction is going down. You can see that this part of the ocean floor, which has become colder now, is going down over here, and material will get heated and rise up and form the volcanic islands. But we have to fit this ocean, this oceanic surface which has been created on a finite Earth, and as the ocean starts standing and spreading and pushing its way around the globe, the continents on the far side collide like this. And when they collide, because they are both light, as long as you had one plate, we'll call this plate, these layers, because they are rigid enough and they are long as compared to their thickness, so we'll call them plates. As long as there was an oceanic plate, which was slightly heavier, it could go down. But when two continental plates, both of the same density, come together, one cannot touch the other so easily, and they crumple and form these mountains. So all these processes that we now see on Earth happening were explained, and this picture you will remember, that we have earthquakes all along here, none here. Very early we had learned that earthquakes mean fractures. And if there are very few fractures over here, what is the conclusion? That these are large areas of the Earth that are rigid. They do not have fracture planes. It is only at their boundaries that you have fracture planes. So if we redraw it a little more clearly over here, this is how it looks. These boundaries are those boundaries, that boundary, for example, between Atlantic between Africa and South America is this boundary over here. This is that boundary. So you can see that earthquakes, which I suggested earlier for fracture zones, really they are globe-girdling fracture systems that dissect the outer brittle plate of the Earth, which then glides over the melted ocean. And by gliding, it is virtually translating whatever is coming from below in a vertical direction into a horizontal. Because it cannot fly in the air, you know, it has to move over the surface. So this is a mechanical transformation that takes place. So about 130 million years ago, remember that India was here, what fossil magnetism had demanded. India started moving, and it still had this ocean in front of it, an old ocean, which is already here in front of it, is here, except that as it is moving, right in front over there is Southern Asia, so it's going under Southern Asia, and this is what this oceanic apron is doing, that part. But as it moves in the chasm created, you have a new ocean growing, and that is this. So the Indian Ocean is young. It began to be born only about 130 million years ago, when India started moving. About 50 million years ago, this entire oceanic plate was consumed under Tibet. And you can see what is happening over here, even as this oceanic plate is going down, as it is going down against Sumatra and Andamans, because of friction, heat is generated, and material melts, comes to the surface to form these volcanic islands. And these are the islands, these are the arcs, volcanic arcs, that we found spread all the way from west to east, just north of the Himalayas, Tibet. And they are known in various forms, the Ladakh granite or Gangtese granite, and so on and so forth. And eventually, about 55 million years ago, when India was still, its northern edge was still somewhere about 6 degrees south, it collided with Southern Asia. So Southern Asia, the edge of Southern Asia was about 6 degrees south latitude, and India has pushed it all the way, it has bulldozed it all the way in this manner, and created this inconsistency. So you can now reconstruct those things. India is moving. There is this part of India which is continental shelf between the continent and the ocean, the entire region which has sedimentary rocks. Eventually, all this is of low density. But the pollution takes place, cannot go down. It's going to become a wedge of rock. And that's what the Himalayas are. They are a wedge of rock. Although some complications will arise, the frontal part of that wedge is where you're sitting on right now. But these rocks were actually, they belong to this part, northern part of India, even when it was in Antarctica. So it belongs to a different age, it belongs to about 500 million years. But it's got involved in this tectonism. And this whole thing goes on. In the beginning, when the continent was still far away from southern edge of Asia, there was a lot of volcanic material that came and lined the southern edge of Tibet, still lines it. And then as it went around, it is here. This is the current strait. Tibet is here now, and you can see that if India is going down still, it could be imagined as equivalent to Tibet riding over it. And 15 years ago when I came here, that was the question I was asking, what is the rate at which it is riding? So, the collision took place. This is still the sedimentary part which got metamorphosed, and that's where we're sitting now. But a lot of melted material came through and made these igneous rocks. Melted material came and solidified, and these are the Indian rocks, I beg your pardon, igneous rocks, which are now called the higher Himalayan granites. And these are the rocks that you encounter when you cross an altitude of something like close to about 4 kilometers, 4,000 meters. And it begins in this region, to go to a place called Munshiari. Many of you might have heard about it, but some of these rocks actually spilled over here. Some of these rocks spilled over here and made a little carpet over here of igneous rocks, and you are sitting right on that carpet. So it is, you can see that all this, which was refuted for a long time, is now found to be the basic type. So that's how Tibet came into being. Vidya, you will warn me. As the continent approached southern Asia, sort of indented into southern Asia, because it happened to be a little bit stronger, more solid than southern Asia. It just indented into it, wrapping southern Asia around its border. So that's how you have these two bends over here. So the remarkable thing about geology, that from this here, which is Nanga Parbat, to this here, which is Namcha Parbat, and that spans a distance of something like 2,400 kilometers, you can see the sequence of rocks about the same. You see these blue ones over here are the youngest. These are the first rocks that you saw when you left Kathmandu. And as you climbed up, you came into these rocks over here, and these are further north of you, but some enclaves of this found over here in that cartoon I showed you how they actually spilled over on these regions. They are not all over as you go from east to west, but they are particularly unique to this part, and they are called Almora granites. But they underlie meta sedimentary rocks. These are just flown over. And this is a picture nearer home where we are sitting. Somewhere over here, and those are the rocks, that's the Almora granite. It has come from further north. It's not a very good picture, but I thought I'll show you exactly where you are. On this is Almora, and these granites have actually come from the north, over here, and they are this kind of rocks that sometimes you see. They are light grey because they have a lot of silica in them, unlike basalts, which are more like ferromagnesium and therefore darker in color. What might be the Himalaya doing? Question I asked, for which I don't think I'll ever be able to thank Dr. Pani adequately, because that work might have waited for another 10 years if he had not helped us. So we decided to use the GPS technology. Actually, it was a plan of mine which had been delayed by 5 years, because in between I was waylaid by then Prime Minister of India and also Delhi. Although I was using a different kind of technology, GPS had not come of age at that time, very long based interferometry. When I left NDRI, and people were more wedded to the shield, and the Himalayas closed that project. So when I left Delhi, and came to Bangalore, I thought, let's use the GPS technology. I had a hard time convincing the government of India that you can trust me with such a sensitive instrument. Sensitive because it will allow me to locate a position within a few millimeters. And in fact, I was denied this permission in the first instance. And then I rang one day, I rang Abdul Kalam, our president, and he understood. He said, you just send me a letter now. And that evening, he actually approved it for this program.
So the GPS resolution is 10 meters or a few meters.
This is different GPS I'm talking about. But I can explain to you how we get millimeters. But if it wasn't that, then of course it won't serve my purpose. So the arrows tell us, the length of the arrows tell us the rate at which different parts of the Himalayas are moving towards Bangalore, where I set up my first reference station. And that reference station, I think, is the only one in India which is known with the highest precision of about 1.6 millimeters. So, here's what we saw. We found out that between Bangalore and let us say Kathgodam, the convergence rate is no more than a couple of millimeters per year. 2,000 kilometers away. 1 millimeter in 2,000 kilometers. The plate is virtually advanced into the belly of the bed, virtually undistorted, undeformed, a little deformed. That deformation will produce an earthquake of magnitude 6 or 7 in 10,000 years. It's very small amount. But, and this increases a little. I come here to Almora. It's around here. If I go further north, Munchiari, it's about 9. And if I go to a place called Milam, and I understand somebody is going to Milam, it's about 17. So, in this 17-18 kilometers, the deceleration of Tibetan plateaus advanced over India from 17-6. What do you think it will do? Because the front part is not moving at all, it's locked, like this. The front part is locked here. It's not moving because this is just 1 millimeter with a strict triangle over here. This is about 6, that's about 16. So this is what is happening. And it is this part of the Great Himalaya which is getting compressed. And as it gets more and more compressed, you will have some medium earthquake. Time will come when the amount of strain here reaches the greatest strain level throughout this width, certain width. And that's the time when this is going to give way, this locking. And once it happens, if it is going to bulldoze it right through away. So, if it is 6 meters, for example, as I have shown, I then calculated it probably 6 in this part of the country, part of the Himalaya, then in about just a minute or 2 minutes, Tibet would advance over the plains of India by as much as 6 meters. And the amount of Tibet that will advance would be something like 300 or 400 kilometers long and 100 kilometers wide. Try to show you that. Last one, this will be about 300 kilometers, and this width will be about 100 kilometers. So this entire patch will break in one fell swoop. There's no way you can leave it in a smaller earthquake, because all such phenomena are shown to follow a fractal distribution, and it means that the largest energy can only be released in one big earthquake. You can't ever hope to release it in smaller. So, this is the paper which I and a friend from US, we collaborated. What we did was we calculated this strain rate accumulating in different parts of the Himalayas. And also we know the failure strain level. And we calculated so how much of potential slip could have accumulated since the last earthquake that we historically know. And although we believe that we can trust them, of course one can never completely guarantee that that no historical records which have been missed, and that's the kind of slip in meters which are a deficit in that area, waiting to be released, whether it will happen tomorrow or 50 years from now, That is something which the scientists cannot tell you. But what they can tell you is something like this, that that's the magnitude of hazard that is potentially present. Another very interesting thing that came over here was that these arrows go on becoming normal to this arc. So it is here in that direction, here in that direction. And this is something which we discovered in 2004, and we proposed that this part of Tibet is actually flowing over India like a fluid, because that's the only way you can explain this arc normal convergence. And this, of course, changes the complete, it changes the requirements of how you model the material behavior for separating deformation. And this is a cartoon, which is actually created by a friend in Cambridge, Dan McKenzie, who did some notes and who was the creator of the tectonic. We used our data to show that indeed that's what Tibet does. Well, earthquake waves allow you to do this tomography of the earth. You can CAT scan the earth and you can see what is inside, just as you can CAT scan the thing. Because the time has come when we want to know this structure a little more underneath the earth in order to be able to understand how it happens. So very quickly, this is a picture produced by a Cambridge student myself, where we look at the inner of the Indian, just beneath the Indian continent and Tibet, at different levels of 15 kilometers, 20, 30, 40, 50, and 70. And you see, as we go deeper, these very deep blues tell you that the material there is extremely hard. And we suspect that probably the convergence of India towards Tibet has come to a stage where this very hard material probably resists subduction and change the course of future movement. And this was again something from Dan McKenzie, who did the same thing in Tibet, and he showed that there is a Tibetan core here. You can see this is India over here, and this is Tibetan core, and that's doing the same thing. So, what are the implications? That's the mountain. What happens to mountains? Like the life and death of a star itself. Well, here's a mountain, and it's been built up because there was pressure from there. Once that pressure ceases, for one reason or the other, and one reason could be the reason because you suddenly encounter a very, very hard material which will resist bending, then erosion takes over, and this starts being eroded, and eventually this core will be left, which will very much look like the shield. Like the shield in South India. So that is the eventual fate of mountains, and we believe that Tibet, the shield in the making, like that. I move fast. That shows life and death of continental fragmentation, building of mountains, and subduction. That tells the story of where we began about 195 million years ago in Antarctica over here. The whole thing continues as such. This is the story of the future. And you see India has half been consumed under Tibet. And the entire Atlantic Ocean has been reduced to this inland sea over here at the fringes of the reduced Indian Ocean. So that's the way the surface of the earth sculpts itself over and over again. We return to this question. We have three planets. And two of them are supposed to be twins. They're very alike in density, in size, only that this is about 10% nearer to the sun than we are, and therefore it lost its water. This is a little smaller, considerably smaller than the Earth, but it's still the same genetic material, but its gravitational cage is too weak to hold any atmosphere. That lost its atmosphere, that lost its water, and this is Mars, so its crust, its lithosphere is so thick that this 27 kilometer thick, I beg your pardon, 27 kilometer high mountain can just sit on it and be supported by it. This couldn't happen on Earth because the asthenosphere will flow, and therefore there will be a limit set to what are the heights of the mountains that you built. Here you have earth, where you have just plate tectonics, because at this, in the thickness of the plate, at that depth, the material melts. Venus is more vigorously convecting. So that was the last one, was the individual, an individual cell, one single plate, which covers the entire planet, unbroken. And here are groups of plates. But of course, an optimum number on Earth makes all the difference as compared to a very large number here on Venus. So we see that these very subtle differences of how the planets revolve in a very different way. And this Goldilocks planet on which we live is the only one that happens to occupy this miracle region of the Christian point of water. You see over here, Mars is somewhere here, Venus is over there. And all biologists would agree that we needed to have their guardians in order that you and I should be talking. But the Earth has not been the same. This is a picture that should tell you as to how the temperature of the Earth has been changing. A very interesting story as to why it should have come about like that. And this is the story of extinction of species. Because there have been times in the Earth's history when virtually 98% of everything that existed biotically died. There's a kaleidoscope of landscapes and cultures which have grown along the Himalaya in response to varying precipitation from just a few tenths of millimeter in the west to several thousand millimeters in the east. And you can see this very beautiful, very kaleidoscopic image of cultures. But there are looming threats over here. I'm coming to the end of my time. You have the musk deer of Kumaon, which is threatened, whose habitats are being depleted. This is the Himalayan vulture. You see, these are the edges of the glaciers, which were measured in 1700 something, and they have been successively measured since. You can see that the top is receding, and the glacier is a dynamic body, so when the top comes down, the bottom goes up. And therefore, you can imagine what's happening. This is tourism in Kashmir, which unfortunately took a religious turn, because a couple of years ago, some indigenous people said that there shouldn't be such a large number of people coming. Don't put so many tents and make tourist houses, because the region just cannot take that much of waste. And I visited this region just about 10 or 12 days ago, and I was appalled to see that the religious fervor is so high. There are a couple of black people every year visiting, every day, who visit the shrine, and the damage to the environment is incalculable. But it suits everybody, it gives some employment to the local people, and it goes on. We see how our Himalayan rivers are receiving less of water because the catchment area is adversely affected. See the women waiting for water. Largely women, unfortunately, is gender biased. Here's the Himalayan oak under threat, and you'll see a yellow wrapper here. And in fact, there's a slogan which says, tie a yellow cloth around the oak tree, just to save it. So those are looming threats. They're dark deprivations because there are a large number of people you see over here. I don't want to elaborate. A shrinking space for civil society initiative as the governance becomes more and more complex, and therefore there is a real quandary we are in. When I come to the Himalaya, I like to end on a personal note. There have been times in certain parts of the Himalayas where I have experienced being disembodied and become presumptuously state. And this could be a delusion. I would be offended if you say it's a delusion. Even if it is, I experience that joy. Himalaya was said to have inspired a lot of philosophy in this country, particularly the Vedic philosophers. And the end of the Vedic period came with Adi Shankar, because the philosophy had spread down to the tip of India at latitude 8 degrees north. Adi Shankar, who lived 788 to 820 AD, and instead, he summed up all the Vedas, and this period is known as the end of Vedas, or Vedanta. Ant is very similar to end, and that says that thou art, that the universal spirit, immanent spirit, are close to you, you are part of it, and the ultimate bliss of life is through meditation, contemplation, recognize that unity within you. In 17th century, one of the rational philosophers of Europe was trying to grapple with the same problem, how to bridge the gap between the creator and the creation. Having come from a Judeo-Christian tradition, when he started experimenting with those ideas, was excommunicated very cruelly. And he also said, there's only one substance, infinite, eternal. He said, if you like, you call it God, if you like, you call it nature, but there is just one. So here is a thought for which I don't have scientific evidence, like the ones that I just on before, which goes against, or which emphasizes the individual, not the group, but implying, and indeed both Shankar and Spinoza said that all everything else that exists are modes of that one. Thank you very much.
In a cluster of the earth, and looking at that, I just drew an analogy with the living cell. You had the nucleus in the earth and then the lithosphere on the top. So looking at all these high mountains, I was wondering, as a biologist, I was thinking about, so what is the real function of these, heavy weights on the earth? And if this is one of the evolutionary way of the earth to somehow control the weak points, to control the, let's say, the underlying lava or volcano, whatever, may I say this? So what is the, and as a geneticist, if I try to pose, what will happen if I remove the heavy weight of Himalayas from the earth? Will the earth will like drift away, or like the, we will lose the balance, or like, with just wild thoughts?
You can hear me. Yes? The Himalayas are just about 8 kilometers high. And they have a route which goes down to about 80 kilometers. And all this is of material, which is about 2700 kg per cubic meter. Whereas in the subsurface, down to 80 kilometers, the material is about 32. So the balance is not going to be disturbed. But all this process essentially comes into way when the earth tries to transfer its interior heat outside. So it's essentially just the flow of heat. And it has, it just happens to be the only planet on earth to be able to do so. It's been able to engineer a very special kind of mechanics to do that, which is called plate tectonics. And that became possible because these plate thickness, controlled by the fact what is the depth at which the material will melt, it will depend on how much water you have, and also what is the thermal gradient. Will depend on the radioactive heat budget of the material inside. This right amount, if you make that plate too thick, it's not going to break easily, as it happens on Mars. So you will have a whole just one individual. If you don't make it too thin, as it happens in Venus, then you will have a large number of plates. So this kind of an organization, which is bound to result because you have large horizontal displacements, and they would take time to build up these stresses, to a limit before diffusion of stresses started taking place. You have to organize itself into a self-criticality like mass before it starts wearing down, covering all that spread of continental material which have somehow come together in one big blanket, which will blanket the heat of the earth for 500 million years. And when you blanket the heat of the earth, because it's a bad conductor of heat, it's continental material, then the region underneath is going to increase in temperature till the material melts, because it's generating heat at a higher rate than it can transfer. When it melts, it boils up. And the moment it boils up, it's going to rift apart. It's going to come as a scissor, move the continent apart. So it's a process which is essentially engineered for heat transfer. And this seems to be a most efficient process.
I believe there was a major volcanic event in the Indian continent when the Deccan Peninsula was formed, and the Deccan Plateau was formed. Was that in any way related to the formation of the Himalayas, or was that did that precede the formation of the Himalayas?
That preceded the formation of the Himalayas, although the convergence was taking place, but it was only the oceanic apron of India which was under thrust in Tibet. This was about 65 million years ago. The actual continental encounter took place more like 55 million years ago.
Right.
So it was about 10 million years behind. But what happened at that time was that between Madagascar, which was a part of India, and the Indian continent, the searing hot plate of material came from below and retreated. So that's how our west coast of India is formed.
Yeah.
And it so happened that there was another piped hot material coming from the mantle, and I haven't gone through that, these are called plumes, which happen to coincide with this. And this conjunction of a plate boundary, spreading plate boundary and plume, caused enormous amount of flood vessels to come and just cover.
Yeah. It seems to me that Earth, tectonic plate, etc., it made a natural system.
Yeah.
So in that context, your measurement of, I know the dynamical system show a little bit chaotic behavior. So your measurement of movement can be changed in small time scale.
Well,
it can be like going one direction, can change their direction.
No, because it will also depend on the inertia of the system. And the inertia of the system is very high. So the time constant of that kind of a change that you are thinking of, in the case of the Earth, particularly in the brittle part, could be something of the order of 15 million years.
It is possible.
Sure. I mean, as I showed you, the climate of the Earth has been changing. I haven't gone into it at all. How it has been, why it has been changing. There has been a biological pump acting there. And that biological pump itself changes drastically as the configuration of continents changes. Because if you take a big continent and huddle them all together, you have an oceanic sort of boundary, which has a certain area. If you break those continents into 10 different parts and disperse them, then the coastal ocean increases by 4 or 5 times. And it's in the coastal ocean that you get a lot of primary sort of activity, which acts as a biological point. So all these processes go on in tandem one with the other.
See, during the last many years, there has been a controversy about the building of dams against rivers in the Himalayas. People have been opposing building of dams, and now it seems some groups are again for the dam and all those things. So in your expert opinion, what should be the approach?
Well, I believe that unless you and I, who live in this kind of environment, opt for a lifestyle which will substantially reduce our personal consumptions, we demand on our elected representatives to do something to produce power. So you have to give them options. It's one of the options. It has its deleterious adverse consequences, as every other option has. The coal fire, the oil fire, the nuclear, they all have. Here I think the challenge is that every time you use a technology which is of a high order, where design parameters are very, very sensitive, you have to think of safety technologies, which are an order of magnitude higher. And that's very important. So when I put a nuclear plant, I should think of every possible thing that could happen, produce redundancy, make sure that there are systems which will be in place when everything has broken down. The same here, in the case of dams. So if you don't mind, I'll just take a minute or so to clear a point which I don't believe any earth scientist in this country understands. And that is, I have shown you that between Kanyakumari or Bangalore and Delhi, this contraction in the plate is virtually zero. And therefore, whatever stresses are there at the back are also here in the front, because there is no stress problem. The plate throughout has the same stress. Wherever you have fractures at depth, you will have stresses accumulating, which will over a period of time, this stress accumulation rate is very slow. So it could be 5,000 years, 10,000 years. But there could be an earthquake wherever you have. If then you have a solid core of rock, maybe nothing will happen, it will just transfer this. Now, when we build our plants or dams, we don't look at what is there inside. We say, oh, there are no micro earthquakes here, there is no other activity, and therefore it is safe. I have completely failed to make anybody understand in this country that this is a simple physics problem. So, every question of whether dam or not dam, nuclear power, I don't think it's an either-or question. It's a question where you have to balance as to what is going to be the benefit, what is going to be the, what are the adverse implications of it, what are the safety measures, that you, and use the highest technology to cover.
The name of the person who proposed this plate tectonic.
Dan McKenzie in Cambridge. Dan Peter McKenzie. Bateson knows him. The friend of ours.
Monish? Yeah. I was just wondering about sort of the scale of energy, because if you have two plates colliding, is there enough energy to actually ripple through the molten layers and thereby lead to reversals in the magnetic properties? Or is it just a different order of magnitude?
Okay, let's first understand that the seat of the magnetic field lies deep in the interior, in the outer core of the Earth, which is fluid. And it's convection in the fluid which causes, like an armature of a dynamo, to produce magnetic currents, which are the magnetic fields. This lies at the depth of 3,000 kilometers from the surface. So, directly it has no interplay at short time scales with the plate. So the geomagnetic phenomenon is completely different. And there, we still don't understand as to why these reversals take place, except that we have models which tell us that there are two states. This is the bistable state. And therefore, given some kind of instability, the planet will flip from one state to the other state. And that happens, for example, when at the outer core of the Earth, where the material is freezing, because in contact with the colder material or heat is going out. It's freezing, it is giving out latent heat, it is cooling, and therefore the material is becoming denser, it is going down and setting up convection current. It might so happen that over the circumference of this spherical shell, at some points you have heterogeneous heat production and heat transfer rate. When that happens, then you can have a lot of heat accumulating there for millions of years, several hundred million years, until the material can exceed the melting point and melt and go up. And when it goes up like a bullet. It goes up like a bullet, I say, because it can traverse as much as 200 kilometers through the solid rock in 24 hours, which is roughly like 10 kilometers an hour. And that is made possible by the fact that as it comes up, the material gets decompressed, its melting point is lowered, and it boils even more, and it just self-propels it. So when that happens, you have enormous amount of lava suddenly coming right from the base of the mantle, right to the surface of the Earth, and that means enormous amount of heat extraction on the circumference, on the surface of the spherical shell, which has the dynamo inside, and that could flip.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have several questions, but I'll restrict to a few only.
Just one.
We'll finish soon. Why do the Himalayas don't have any active or dormant volcanoes?
In the picture that I showed you, the volcanoes were formed and finished before the continental plates collided. Those volcanoes, as I said, are in the north.
Let's move on to other speech because we must discuss. Could you say something about the
formation
of the Shivaliks?
Yes.
Something about how the Shivaliks
came into being. The question is that as we move towards the plains, before we get onto the alluvium, we have these suite of rocks called Shivaliks. And these are sedimentary rocks, they are of recent origin. They are rocks which have been formed by the deposition of detritus brought from the Himalayas. A lot of it is transported through the Ganga basin to Hooghly and maybe the edge of Padma. But a lot of material gets deposited here also. And some of it is entrained in the movement of the plate. As the plate moves, some of it is entrained as a part of the wedge. So that's the genesis of the Shivalik.
Okay, last question, Manchavi. Yes.
There was one river being discovered in Amazon, I don't remember its name now.
Beg your pardon?
There was one river being discovered in Amazon. So
Amazon?
Yeah, I don't remember its name, it's underground. Mm-hmm. It's being discovered underground and its existence is being not, I mean, it's not being proved. I mean, they have all, only proven the basis of the heat changes which are taking place.
Yeah.
So, do you have any evidence of some kind of similar river being, I mean, because you have conducted so many of heat change studies, I think.
Yeah.
So, is there any proof of some kind of inland river being running in certain okay. part of India also?
Okay. On a smaller scale, we have lots of evidence for underground water stream and, you know, water through caves. I remember in South India near Nellore, I myself went underneath the cave. This happens when you have a large thickness of limestone deposits. Limestone is easily soluble in acidic water. So whenever the water gets acidic, or the rain, or industrial pollution, or just leaching out acidic materials from the soil, it dissolves. Over millions of years, it will create an underground passage. And if the source of water is available, then of course it will become a stream, a river, a small seepage, or whatever you like. So I wouldn't be surprised that there could be some such river. It is of course of enormous societal implication if you can discover some such river, because then you know you can tap it. But that's not a surprise. We know how, what are the conditions under which this could happen.
I think this discussion can continue very much longer. It's such an exciting talk, but we must come.